32. Psalm 32. We're only going to take half the psalm today. The title of the message is The Power of Unconfessed Sin. The Power of Unconfessed Sin. 30 years ago, I read a quote from a psychologist, and he said that if we had an answer to the guilt problem, we could clean out 90% of our mental institutions. Basically, he said, people just cannot get past the guilt. If you do a Google search or some other type of search engine, you'll find article after article about guilt and shame. Many of these do not come from a Christian worldview. They come from a secular worldview. But it does not matter which worldview you come from, guilt is a problem. And so, as a Christian, I come from it from a biblical worldview. I read a humorous story about Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Do any of you know who that is? Maybe two of you, all right? Anybody know who Sherlock Holmes is? Well, he's the man that was the novelist that created that character. And he was known to basically play jokes on his friends. And so he sent a telegram that was from an anonymous source to 12 friends, and this is what it said. It said, all has been discovered, flee at once. Within 24 hours, all 12 of these men had left the country. Evidently, they had some things that were in their closet that they didn't want out. And so when I read that, I thought, you know, that's probably true of God's people. There are probably some things that have taken place in our lives that that we would be embarrassed about. Years ago, there was a guy that was on the radio and somebody would say, why don't you run for office? He said, I've got too many skeletons in my closet. And so today, I want us to look at this psalm and I want you to think about David, this great character in the Bible, and how he was affected. This is not a penitent psalm. If you want to know about David's great sins, all you need to do is read Psalm 51. This is a psalm of thanks. This is a psalm of how he dealt with that sin and what took place. And so this is not a negative song at all. As a matter of fact, if you look at the title, if you look under your Bible heading there and it says Psalm 32, it'll say something like this, a Psalm of David, Maskell. The word Maskell is about 12 to 14 of the Psalms, and they are known as teaching songs. So in other words, the way that you maybe would teach your children ABCs. Do you remember the little song? A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and whatever comes next. Right. You teach them those songs, all right? You teach them how to count. One little, two little, three little Indians, four little, five little, six little Indians. Remember that? Well, this is a song of teaching. And so, he is wanting them to be instructed. He's wanting to make sure that he gives them something so that they can understand the way that they're supposed to interact with the Lord. And so, the man that writes this psalm, he is the front runner for the chastisement of God for about a year. If you know anything about this story, it's a story that takes place over in 2 Samuel. I may allude to that here in just a little bit, But you know the story, how that David has one major turning point in his life. Up until one point, everything is climbing. But once that point hits, and you know the point I'm talking about, it's not Goliath, it's Bathsheba. From that point forward, the man struggles mightily. And so as we look at our psalm today, I want us to look, and I title this basically like three stanzas, or outlined it as three stanzas. You know how that we will sing a verse to a song and then the chorus, and then another verse and then the chorus? Well, I've taken verses 1 and 2, then verses 3 and 4, and then verses 5 and 6, and I have basically given it a little title. And so the first thing that I want us to see is stanza 1. That's found in verses 1 and 2, and it's his song of rejoicing. The song of rejoicing. I want you to notice that he begins with the word blessed. May I say that that word means happy? Do you know when Jesus was preaching over at the location for the Sermon on the Mount? That's where he gave what we call the Beatitudes, where he said blessed and blessed. He said it 9 times. Well, this psalm and one other psalm are the only ones that I personally know of and can remember. And that other psalm is Psalm 1. That's the psalm that talks about the man that says, blessed is the man that walketh not, you know, in the, I didn't forgot how it goes now, those who walk right, they stand right, they sit right, they meditate on the Lord day and night, all right? And we could take time to go to it, but you know it. A man that walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. You remember those. Well, here we have another blessed. Happy is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Blessed is the man unto whom the Lord imputeth not iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no guile. In Psalm 1, you find a man that just does the right thing. But in Psalm 32, you find a man and he's walking, he comes to a fork in the road. I never think about a fork in the road without thinking about Robert Frost, all right? Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and I took the one less traveled by. Well, I'm thinking about this road here in Psalm 32. You don't have a man that walks right. You have a man that's chosen the wrong path. And he's rejoicing that when he turned and he came back, he found the same Lord there with open arms, ready for him to be basically reclaimed and his fellowship restored. Now, if you look at verses 1 and 2, you'll notice there are 4 words that are used to describe sin. Each one of them have a different meaning. Now, in all of the Old Testament, there are 15 words that describe sin. And each one of them have little variations of what they mean. But I want you to take a pen or a highlighter, and I want you to look at the little word transgression and either underline it or highlight it. Now, what does the word transgression mean? It has the idea of a willful rebellion. In other words, I know what I'm supposed to do, but I'm just not going to do it. That is what some people do. In other words, from the time they're a little girl or a little boy, they have been told what is right and what's wrong. But maybe they get to a certain age and they go, I will not do that any longer. And so they know what the line is and they step across the line. That's what we do sometimes. We know where the Word of God tells us that we ought to go. But yet what do? We willfully step across the line. That is a transgression. Well, I want you to look at the latter part of verse 1, and it uses the word that we used kind of generically. It's the word sin. So you have a transgression and then you have a sin. Now, what is that? A sin is to fall short of the mark. It was kind of funny. We were, my grandson and my middle granddaughter, my middle grandchild, all right? My 9-year-old and my 6-year-old, they went with me to my mom's, all right? I bribed them to go. I told them I would take you fishing, all right? And as a grandparent, you know, you're not above bribes, you know? And so we went, and I did. I took them fishing. And I was working on a rod because they had already broken one of them, and I'm trying to fix it. And next thing I know, I hear a commotion, and out by the dock, there's a jumping up and down, and then I hear a splash. It wasn't the kid, it was the fish that got off. Carter had caught him a little fish. I say a little fish. I said, how big was it? I said, was it this big or this big? He said, oh, it was big. It was huge. I said, was it really big? He said, Papa, it was really big. And I asked Libby, I said, Libby, how big was it? She said, Papa, it was a megalodon. All right? Evidently, that's a term kids use nowadays. All right? And so I took them down there with me. And on the way back, I was telling them, you know, maybe what we'll do is if they go with me in the next year, you know, maybe I'll let Carter, because he's going to be 10, maybe I'll teach him how to shoot a gun. And Libby goes, can I shoot a gun? And I said, well, Shug, you won't be but about 7. And I said, that might be a little early. She said, I tell you what you can do. You can buy me a bow and arrow. Well, a bow and arrow would fit in this point here where it's missing the mark. You think about pulling that bow back, and we've got two expert bowsmen in this church that I know of. We've got Hub back there. You know, I mean, he's good with a bow. And we got Brad right over here. He's good with a bow. And I mean, these guys, I mean, they can knock a fly off a fence at 50 yards. I mean, they're just good, all right? And so you take that bow and you pull it back and you shoot, and all of a sudden it drops and it doesn't hit the bullseye. You've fallen short of the mark. That's what sin is. In other words, there's a mark that's out there and you're trying to get there, but all have sinned and come short, fallen short of the glory of God. But if you look at verse number 3 or 2, there's another word. There's the word iniquity, all right? It says, blessed is the man unto whom the Lord imputeth not iniquity. What does that word mean? That has the idea of being bent or twisted, right? In other words, there's just some things that we do and they are bent. They're not anything that can be used. And it's a good thing when the Lord does not impute those things to us. Now, the word impute is a word in accounting. So in other words, God is not going to take something that is evil and he's not going to put it on our account. He's going to take the evil things away. Now, he will take our sin upon himself. That's what Jesus did when he died on the cross. But what he did was he took our sin and he gave us his righteousness. We have the righteousness of Christ. And so David said, the Lord's not going to impute iniquity. He's not going to take something that is twisted, something that's bent, and force that upon us. But then there's another word, the last word in verse number 2. It says guile. That word means deceit. In other words, blessed is the man whom the Lord doesn't impute iniquity and in whose spirit there is no deceitfulness. In other words, we want to live our lives so holy, so close to God, that we don't even have deceitfulness or deceit that's in our hearts. Now that's hard, because the Bible says that the heart of a person is deceitful and desperately wicked. But I'm telling you, I believe that there are some people that have grown so much in the Lord, they guard their hearts so much that I would trust them probably with anything except my salvation. I only trust Jesus with my salvation. And so you've got those four words. You've got transgression, you've got sin, you've got iniquity, and you've got guile. And so in stanza one, he is rejoicing. He said, oh, happy is that man that has all of this done away with. And he's excited as he can be. But there's a second thing that I want you to see. Look at verse number 3 and verse number 4. In stanza number 2, we see that he's singing about remembering. Remembering. He said, when I kept silence, in other words, when I didn't confess, my bones waxed old. My bones became like an old person through my roaring. And in the King James, the word roaring there, it has the idea of groaning. In other words, my body was hurting so much that all day long, I just groaned. You know, the older we get, sometimes we groan. I was groaning one time and my wife said, are you okay? I said, yeah, it just feels good to moan a little bit. Anybody ever had that happen? It's like, man, that feels good, all right? Well, David, here he is. He's a man probably in his mid-40s at this time. And he said, when I didn't confess, he said, I just groaned. It was as though my bones hurt. And so, he's looking back. He's remembering. Now, what was he looking back on? Well, he was thinking about what happened one day when he was walking around at his palace. Now, you can go to this palace in Jerusalem today. Up above it, there's really a restaurant, but underneath it, where the dig is, you can kind of walk around and you can see the ruins that are in this particular place. And they say that it's the second highest elevation in all of Jerusalem. And somebody would say, well, why did David, being the king, not take the highest elevation? Because David's thought was, God gets the best. And so you've got King David in this second elevation. And as he walks out, and you can do this, you can walk out and you can look down the hill and you can see where, just in your mind, you can visualize where his officers and their families would live in little cubicles and rooms. If you look carefully out to your right, you can see where that there's a stone wall and then there's a divide, and the bricks that and the blocks that are there are more precise. And I asked a guide one time, I said, what's the difference in those two? And he said, oh, said, this side is what was built during David's time. But where it starts again with a different look, that's during Nehemiah's time. That was the wall that Nehemiah had built. And so I'm just visualizing this story as I'm standing there and I'm looking down, and you could just see right over there where a top of a house would be, and there would be a beautiful lady and she would be taking a bath. And David had lust stirred in his heart. He sends one of his most trusted servants and said, go call her. And he brings her to his palace, and of course he commits adultery. And then he sends her back home. But it's not long before word gets back to him, Bathsheba's with child. So he gets it in his mind. I tell you what I'll do. I will bring her husband home. So he calls for Uriah to come home. He brings him in. You're doing a good job, Uriah. I want to give you a 2-day pass. I want you to go home and I want you to maybe spend some time with your wife. How about that? Don't you think that'd be great? And so, instead of Uriah going home, because he's got his brothers in arms, they're still fighting. Because you see, it was a time when kings go forth to battle, but David didn't go. He stayed at home and he sent Joab in his place. And so Uriah, he goes, how can I go home and enjoy intimacy with my wife? How can I do that? My friends, my co-soldiers, they don't get to. So he sleeps outside of David's door that night on the floor. David hears about it the next day and he goes, hey, I thought you were going home. I couldn't do that. I shouldn't have the privileges of marital life when my soldiers, my buddies, they don't get to. So David says, hey, I know what I'll do. I'll get him liquored up. And so he gets him to drinking. And he goes, now go home. And maybe he's going to forget and go home, you know, and maybe he'll think, well, maybe I did get Bathsheba pregnant. All of a sudden, he's not that drunk. And he doesn't go. And so finally, David goes, okay, I tried to get out of it the easy way. See, God's not even in the equation right now, folks. So what does he do? By his own hand, he takes a little quill, a little bit of ink, and he begins to write it. He dries it. He folds it. He stamps it with the king's seal, hands it to Uriah and says, give this to Joab. And when he gives it to Joab, Joab opens it up and he goes, whoa, no, I don't think I'll destroy this. I think I'll keep this. This could be a get out of jail free card for me later. This is in the king's handwriting. And if he ever tries anything with me, I could produce this. I could blackmail him. So he kind of sticks it in his coat pocket. Well, they put Uriah on the front, the heated part of the battle. I mean, it's hot. Then they give the retreat and they leave Uriah and he is killed. And then a few weeks later, after a hypocritical time of mourning, David takes Bathsheba to be his wife, like he's doing something altruistic. Oh, one of my soldiers was killed. I'll take his wife. She'll be my wife. I'll make sure she's taken care of. Everybody knows. Because the walls have ears. Everybody knows. Now, David is self-deceived. He thinks he's getting away with it. And so he clicks along for a year. Oh, but the bones are waxing old. Oh, if you looked at verse number 4, it says, day and night, the heavy hand of God was upon him. He said, that vitality that was in my body, he said, it's like now it's being dried up in the summer sun. And so he clicks along for about a year like that. And one day there's an old prophet of God named Nathan. And he walks in and he goes, good to see you, King. Let me tell you a story. There's two men. One man is wealthy. He has all the sheep, all the goats, all the livestock that a person's heart could desire. But then the other man, he's got one little ewe sheep. Just one. And so there's going to be a big feast. And so instead of the rich man taking one of his little lambs, he goes over and he takes the lamb from the man that only has one, just one little ewe sheep. And he takes it, kills it, dresses it, and he uses that man's one little sheep. And David is mad. I mean, he is just ticked off. He is wroth. He said, you tell me who that man is, and I'll make him restore that man fourfold. And the old prophet of God squints his eyes, and he points his finger at him, and he says, thou art the man. And David knew he'd been found out. Oh, and he was broken. And if you want to read the story of his brokenness, you turn to Psalm 51, not now, but later today. And you can read all about David and his brokenness. Oh, but what's he doing right now? He's remembering. Oh, he's been affected. He remembers how he was emotionally affected. He remembers how physically he was affected. He remembers how psychologically he was affected. And I mean, when you begin to look at David I mean, there is no doubt, no doubt, that he was so thrilled when he was restored the joy of his salvation. When the Spirit of God would come back upon him and just give him that sweetness. But you see, it didn't happen until after the confession. If you look at verses 5 and 6, we'll see stanza 3. In stanza 3, he sings about his restoration. He talks about how it happened, how that he confessed. Proverbs 28:13 basically says this, that whoever conceals his transgression will not prosper. But if you don't conceal it, you will obtain mercy. The Bible tells us in 1 John chapter 1, verse 9, I tell people, and I've told young people this for years, it is God's bar of soap. If you want to get clean, go to 1 John 1, 9. If we confess our sin, he's faithful and just to forgive us our sin and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. David understood that confession was something that he needed to take care of. He needed to take care of it. There's a lady named Portia Nelson, and she wrote an essay. She said it was an autobiography in 5 chapters. And basically, the chapters are a progression. And the whole thing was, you don't have to sin. Now, I know somebody says, well, I'm a sinner by nature, so I guess I got to get my quota in. I heard about one little boy. He was in a class, and the teacher said, young people, what is the difference between a sin of commission and the sin of omission? And everybody was asking these different things. And finally, one little boy said, well, a sin of commission is the things that you do. And a sin of omission is the things you hadn't got around to yet. Well, that's not exactly right. The sin of omission is the things that you know to do, but don't do it. And so Portia Nelson said this, chapter 1. She said, I walk down a street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I'm lost, but I say it's really not my fault. Chapter 2. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in it again. I can't believe I'm at the same place again. I still don't think it's my fault, and it takes me a while to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it there, but I still fall in it. It's my habit. My eyes are finally open. I know it's my fault now. And so I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5, I walk down another street. Can I tell you that sin is like that hole in the sidewalk? I've known of some folks and they want to get as close to the world as they possibly can. When in truth, what they ought to do is they ought to say, I want to get as far away from the world as I possibly can. You know, it's kind of like walking the fence. If you're on top of a fence and you got the world here and the Christian life here, you know, a strong wind comes by, it may knock you that way. If that fence shakes a little bit, somebody reaches up and begins to pull you, you're going to fall off on the world side. Oh, but if you're not walking that close, you're walking over here, you're happy. You're blessed. Why? Because there's not a hole to fall in. Now, are you going to be tempted? Sure, you're going to be tempted. But I'm going to tell you something. We've got folks sitting here today, and some of you, and there's probably 20, 40, 50 of you, and you're probably thinking, I can't tell you the number of times I've fallen in that same hole. Why don't you get away from the road and the sidewalk that's got the hole on it? Just get away from it. Sin can be avoided if we want it to be. Now, let me just say this. Confession is not just saying, I'm sorry. There is something that comes along with confession that you will see if you read Psalm 51. It's a word called contrition. You can say, I want forgiveness. But if you don't have a broken and contrite heart, you're lying to God and you're lying to yourself. You see, when people truly are sorry for their sins, sometimes there's tears. Sometime when you're sorry for those sins, there is a heaviness about those sins. Sometimes we have people and they'll come walking the aisle and, you know, and they're chewing their chewing gum and, yeah, I want to get saved. But there's no humility. When you sin and you're asking forgiveness, there ought to be something humble in that. There's not an arrogance that goes with being forgiven of sin. There's a humility that goes with that. When that hand of God, and by the way, you realize that is just a figure of speech describing the effect that when the pressure is there. God is a spirit. He does not have a hand as you and I have a hand. But there are times when I close a letter and I'll say something like this, may the good hand of God rest upon you. What I mean is I want God's blessings upon your life. I don't want the heavy hand of God, which is what David experienced when he said that God's hand was heavy upon him and the moisture in his bones were drying up. Confession is something that can be had, but there's got to be a deep desire to want it. An insincere confession simply leads to more guilt. You have a heaviness here today, don't play around and make like you want to get right with God, because it's only going to get worse. But if you truly want help, you can get it. Many years ago, there was a newspaper in Madrid, and a father had a son, and he had left home. They had had words, and his father loved his boy. So he went to the local newspaper there in Madrid, the one that was the most circulated, and he took out an ad, and it said this. It said, Dear Paco, I want you to come home. All is forgiven. I love you. Meet me in front of the newspaper office tomorrow at noon. The story's told the next day, 800 Pacos were in front of the newspaper office. If you want forgiveness, you can have it. But if you have unconfessed sin, there is a power. Oh, it'll just keep pressing you. And it'll push you down, and it will cause you to have sleepless nights. If you're lost, that sin that so weights you down can be forgiven. And if you're a Christian and you've come to that fork in the road and you've taken the wrong fork, you can come back and you'll find the Lord there with open arms. You can be a Paco this morning. Let's stand together.